You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock.
So I'm getting ready for my bucket and spade holiday in Cornwall. I'm making like an MP, James. I'm off. You've gone one better, though.
This is not a competition, Caroline.
Isn't it?
It definitely is not. But yes, I am going to a special dinner this evening.
And I hear it's dozens and dozens of Jameses from all across Westminster. What on earth is this all about?
A lot of Jameses in Westminster got together and decided there were so many of us that it had to become a charitable issue.
Right.
And I have been invited, as someone who works in Westminster, to a dinner of Jameses. All the proceeds go to charity. James Cleverly is the keynote speaker.
Aha, and that's the key.
I'm a key, Caroline Hepke. And so it's going to be an absolute nightmare because, hi, how are you? Oh, I'm James. I don't know how we're going to do it. It's all going to be surnames. I'll have to report back.
This is sounding more and more school-esque, isn't it? If you're going to go by your family names.
Have I told you where it is?
Tell me.
It's at James's restaurant.
Well, now everybody knows. You're going to be mobbed. Look, are you going to be discussing politics over your charity supper? I imagine you are, surely. And perhaps the big nasties are going to come up. This, of course, is the headline phrase out of Meg Hillier and the Public Accounts Committee today. Their report into government finances is pretty scary stuff.
It kind of reads like an end-of-year report where the whole class has failed. It is 19 issues that the Public Accounts, which is a cross-party, five different sort of parties, lots of MPs, but from five different parties sit on it. And they have highlighted anything from health, defence, education, climate. We'll get into a few more of those exact details with our sort of editor, Alex Morales, a bit later, where billions, and they mean billions, of pounds are needed to right the ship of the UK state. And if that money is not spent, they forecast disaster.
Yeah, look, it is an absolutely eye-watering sort of sum that they are looking at, and consequences too. Look, one could even add to that very, very long list of money needed a 20th horrible nasty. And this is Thames Water. The crisis there is only deepening. Investors were meant to put in £500 million for the turnaround plan for Thames Water. They're not going to, or they're saying that they're not going to be able to. Shareholders in the parent company, Kemble Water. This is a disaster with plenty of blame to go around. It's not even really unwound yet. I mean, Ofwat, the government, plus the company themselves.
Well, the thing is that they say that, this is the investors, that the regulators have made this uninvestable. Now, why this matters is because when we come on to talk about the stuff with Alex Morales, these private solutions are seen by Labour as one of the big ways out. So at this very early stage, we're not even talking about, you know, when the general election is yet, a series of private investors are saying, excuse me, this is uninvestable. Where's the case? It's not going to be sort of a universal solution, Caroline, but it's a worrying sign.
No, look, and this is because, you know, partly Thames Water is a failure of private business, you know, as well as a failure of the regulators Ofwat. I mean, the government is has drawn up plans to potentially bring Thames Water into special administration. It's kind of on the brink, and it's a story that we have covered kind of every twist and turn. So, yeah, it's a really big worry.
Well, going back to this bombshell report on the 19 big nasties haunting the future government, Bloomberg's UK government editor Alex Morales joins us in the studio. So, Alex, what is so nasty about a big nasty?
I think you're referring to the Public Accounts Committee report.
Yes.
Well, what's so nasty about it is it's a bunch of expenses, very expensive expenses that the government needs to spend at some point but has not yet allocated money to and can't keep punting the can down the road. So Meg Hillier, who's the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, has identified, I think it's just short of 20 big nasties. And they, you know, they range from everything from the sort of usual things that you know about that shortfalls in the health service, spending on schools and hospitals, to deeply unsexy things like, a sort of big institute that looks into animal diseases that's crumbling and needs replacement. So these are expenses, she said, the government have punted forward and, you know, taken short-term decisions for years and years and years, but the next government's going to have to deal with.
Although one of them is you know, bigger than the others and sort of more existential, if you like, in a more fragile, turbulent world, and that is defence spending that's also in there as one of those kind of big nasties. I mean, the UK's in a real fiscal straitjacket then. I mean, I suppose illuminating this, who does it really help? Who does it hinder?
To be honest, it's not good for either party because, we're obviously heading for a general election within the next 10 months. It looks very likely that the Labour Party will win that election if you look at all the polls. But Labour Labour's the party that you would associate with the sort of public spending that might resolve some of these problems. But Labour's sort of foisted a fiscal straitjacket on itself in its attempts to get elected. It sort of wants to decontaminate the brand that developed under Jeremy Corbyn, the public associated Labour with all these big spending decisions. So Labour have said we're not going to raise all the main rates of tax, but that leaves them very little room to raise money to make any of these spending decisions that Meg Hillier says are needed.
And it's quite stark reading this report. I mean, I was looking at it this morning, Alex, and like Caroline says, it's $17 billion just to keep the defence contracts going, another $65 billion if you want to actually upgrade them in the way the military would like. You've got things like $11 billion to replace legacy IT systems, $20 billion to sort of replace affordable housing, net zero targets, improving the infrastructure to sort of build the research. It's basically every like light on the dashboard one can think of. How do politicians respond to this kind of bleak outlook where you have like Labour couldn't even stand by a $28 billion pledge for sort of their green policies? How on earth are they going to try and find the funds for a $65 billion defence pledge?
Well, I mean, it's something that all governments at all times have to deal with. You know, if you took all the spending requests from every single government department, they would way exceed the budget at all times. So the governments are constantly trying to prioritise. But certainly after 10 years of spending austerity in the last decade, departments have been pared back to sort of the bare minimum. And so the incoming government's going to have to decide what its priorities are. And clearly that's going to have to involve trade-offs. They may have to reduce what defence gets if they want to make a big push on net zero. And, you know, we've already seen Labour in recent months retreat on some of its green pledges because it realised that the spending commitments it was making appeared unaffordable.
I mean, one of the big ones that was raised is this idea of nuclear submarines. I mean, they point out that we haven't decommissioned a nuclear submarine since World War II, which is quite astonishing when you read it. And the idea being that there are some very tough choices ahead.
Well, there are actually two things on nuclear submarines in the report. One is decommissioning the old ones, which needs a considerable amount of money. And the other is maintaining the new fleet, keeping Britain's presence as a nuclear power in patrolling the world's seas.
Yeah, no, absolutely, which is why I sort of said existential, or at least, the kind of deterrent that the UK has. Look, the other thought, though, that comes to mind is what benefit might Labour have in terms of at least having a longer road with which to make these decisions? I mean, you know, when we hear from Rachel Reeves and from Keir Starmer, they are focused on getting a two-term government. Does that help in this kind of very difficult decision-making environment they're going to probably have?
Well, I think it sort of depends on how confident you are that you'll win that second term, because if you're going to make these sort of long-term decisions, you need to make them at the beginning of the first term. And if you think they're going to make you very unpopular and make you lose that second election, then it's kind of moot whether you do them or not, because the next government could just go and override them. So you have to be pretty confident you're going to get these two terms. You have to set a clear pathway that extends beyond the end of the parliament, so that these public services know the money's coming. They know they can plan. You know, if you're running a hospital and you need to have a rolling run of repairs, you need to know the money's going to come in over the next 3, 4, 5, 10 years to carry out that rolling program of repairs. And the same for schools, and you know, the same for all these courts. You know, I've just done jury service, and I can attest that the court buildings are crumbling. There were leaks and peeling paint when I was there.
And it's going to be a huge bill potentially for whichever government gets in next. Alex, thank you so much for being with us. Bloomberg's UK government editor, Alex Morales.
One of those big nasties we just discussed is local government finance. Keir Starmer is launching Labour's local election campaign today, and we're also likely to get the final list of candidates running to be the London mayor. Hackney in East London elected Labour's Carolyn Woodley as the local mayor, as opposed to Sadiq Khan, the sort of citywide mayor, last November. Hackney have since put up council tax by 5% in March. That is the maximum increase you can make without issuing a Section 114 notice, which the council did back in 2000. So joining us now is Carolyn Woodley. Carolyn, can you explain to us, a lot of our listeners won't follow this very closely, what is the state of local government finance?
Yeah, I think if we speak broadly, it's really, really under pressure. I mean, you'll have seen councils go under, you'll have seen those Section 114s issued on some councils. Luckily, Hackney is now in a position of being really financially well managed, but that doesn't mean to say we're not creaking, you know, we're under huge pressure ourselves as well. And so you were referring earlier to council tax increases. I mean, that's something that we all have to do. One thing we're doing sort of in mitigation in Hackney is increasing our council tax reduction scheme. So that's essentially the discount that we give to council taxpayers who are in financial need. So we've increased that discount up to 90% this year. That's 2 years ahead of our sort of promised manifesto commitment. And we're moving towards trying to get 100% discount by 2030 for those who need that mitigation. But essentially, we're absolutely reliant on those council tax increases in order to keep our services going, quite frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking at the budget in Hackney, £52 million in savings still required over the next 3 years. I mean, I'd be interested to understand how you're thinking about trying to balance the books. I mean, just under half of all the council tax revenue that you're collecting is going to be spent on adult social care.
Yeah, all the pressures are really in social care. We are obviously always looking at sort of income generation and ways to transform our services to make them more efficient. But, you know, there's only so many times you can do that without having to look into those really well-loved discretionary services, those things that are really visible, and to kind of take away some of those opportunities to access things like libraries, children's centres, all of that. That's where our residents start to feel really hurt and sort of impacted. So we have to be really careful in the way that we do any of these kind of savings and to really understand the cumulative
just
impact.
Briefly, Caroline, when you say discretionary services, I know what you mean, but I think a lot of our audience won't quite understand what it is a council does and what it is legally required to do and what it is sort of, as you put it, discretionary. So, I mean, broadly, the word I keep coming back to is this difficult decisions, this phrase. What are the sort of difficult decisions you're going to have to make in the coming months and years? Can you walk us through what you spend on and what you're struggling to spend on?
Yeah, we have to do a combination of transformation, which is around making sure we meet our sort of statutory duties. So that difference between statutory and discretionary that they referred to. There are things that we legally have to do as a council We have to provide, for example, sufficient childcare. We have to provide a certain level, a certain standard of social care. We have to provide support to education. There are many statutory duties we have to meet. When I talk about discretionary, that's those things that are really important to us in terms of early help, prevention. We're really passionate about work around sort of our Young Hackney, Discover Young Hackney, supporting youth here, our support to our voluntary community sector, as I say, our libraries, our children's centres, those things that really make a difference on the ground, perhaps that make a long-term saving, but don't necessarily have to be done in terms of meeting our statutory duties. And, you know, our argument, I guess, as local councils is that we know where we can make interventions that will make a really positive impact for our residents, and we don't want to salami slice away those discretionary services. But if we can't get sufficient funding for our core statutory services, then we're in trouble.
Do you think that if the Labour government were to, if a Labour government were to get in at a national level, things would get any easier? I mean, we spend a lot of our time looking at the kind of national economic outlook for the UK. Keir Starmer's launching Labour's local election campaign today. Obviously, Labour dominates the capital in terms of local government. Do you think it will get any easier under Keir Starmer, realistically?
Yes, I do. And not because I think there's going to be a lot more money overnight, but because we'll have planning. What we've been having to deal with in local government is really short-term planning, you know, one-year grants. You know, we fought for the household support fund to be extended. We got it for 6 months. There's just such an uncertainty around any funding we're drawing down at the moment, and a real sense of drift as well. I mean, I know Gillian Keegan was talking about SEND yesterday, but, you know, I'm one of those councils that's holding in the region of 20 million deficit for special education needs and disabilities, and there's no real sense of how we're going to tackle that. And this, you know, we're actually one of the councils that have been managing our SEND deficit quite well. There are others that have much, much larger debts, and that's just one example. You know, social care, there are so many areas that we just feel this sense of drift from central government, that they're not tackling the problem, and we don't have a sense of what the future looks like. So what I think will happen overnight with the Labour government is that they'll give us, you know, at least a 2-year sort of commitment on those core kind of grants that we really need to know how much money is coming in, so we know what we've got to work with. Like, every single council will do what has to be done. If we have to reduce services, if we have to reduce staff, if we have to do whatever we have to do to balance the books, we'll do it. But, you know, we want to plan in a positive way, bring in partnership in mitigation. We have a really strong relationship with our strategic partners in Hackney, and they want to help. So if we know, you know, where the shortfall is, where the opportunity is over a sort of, you know, at least a 2-year period, then we can kind of galvanise the troops to help us. And, you know, as I say, people just really want to help. There is an amazing spirit in Hackney from the ground up. And you saw that probably across the country in terms of the pandemic, people kind of getting involved, supporting food delivery, food poverty. There's a sense of sustainability of in terms of how we continue that, because we've had to with the energy crisis, with the cost of living crisis. But we need to know where we're going to be in a couple of years' time. You know, is that something that that we need to find ways to kind of embed in our infrastructure, our community and voluntary sector infrastructure? Or are we going to be easing away from it because we're going to be heading towards a better place? You know,
it's interesting because you frame it.
I think Kim will answer those questions almost overnight.
Overnight, you say? Okay. I mean, so what is interesting is you frame that as quite a positive story about the community, but you could also look at it as you're pushing for 2-year emergency funding, and in the meantime, you're having to rely on the community to sort of fill the backstop here. When you get that kind of money, if the national government were to give it, would you also be pushing this future Labour government to be able to raise council tax by much more to then cover sort of the long-term plans and the long-term deficits you might have?
I don't want council tax to be the only solution. There has to be an alternative here in terms of, you know, prioritisation, how you, the expectation from local government, devolution to local government, you know, how much more control can they give us over other areas of our spend. I think that there's great expertise within the sort of the key ministers that I hope to see appointed in the Labour government, who really get it. You know, Jim McMahon, Angela Rayner, they really understand local government. And I think they can do something more ambitious than simply allowing us to increase our council tax. That's not necessarily going to be what our residents, you know, want to see
absolutely.
As a solution.
No, look, I'm a London resident, very familiar with the council tax issues in the capital. But your message when you were elected in November last year was also on new homes, I notice, in terms of building 1,000 new council homes. This, again, is it's a hot-button issue nationally and in London. How quickly do you think that the Labour Party are going to be able to reform planning, which is one of those major pledges that surely has got to be in the manifesto? How fast do you think that Labour could deliver on major planning reform?
Yeah, I'm not sure how fast that can be. I think most of these things probably take in the region of a year. But we already have, our sort of asset review, as most local councils will have done. We understand where we can do infill. We understand where we can build. We've already identified sites. We're already progressing in that direction. Those 1,000 homes, that commitment is in place. And also, I was really pleased to see Steve Carney increase his commitment in terms of 40,000 council homes across 32 councils. That means we could potentially, and I don't know, I'd have to unpack the detail, but, potentially double our commitment, which is really significant for a borough like Hackney. I imagine it wouldn't be overnight to kind of change that planning legislation for the wider ambitions that the Labour Party has in terms of brownfield or greyfield sites. But that's not actually a blocker for us in Hackney. We're ready to go.
I just want to ask, a big issue you see in sort of the national report around the story is a lot of councils haven't had their accounts audited in many years. Do you know when Hackney was last audited?
We have an audit committee who reports regularly on our finances, did a really good piece of work around reserves in terms of external auditing. I would have to check, I have to admit.
At least according to your website, I mean, I defer to you, the mayor, on it, but it looks like it was about 2019, 2020, at least externally okay. audited. The reason I sort of raise it is there a risk here? A new government comes in, reviews pick up, like you say, maybe there is two-year funding, maybe there isn't, in the hypothetical, that bigger holes in the finances are there. And if that is the case, you're going to have some very tough decisions on spending. Do you think there is a chance that you'll still have to make some of these big cuts going forward?
I mean, we are going to have to make big cuts going forward. As you say, we've moved from a 57 million budget shortfall in the last medium-term financial plan. Now we're on a 52 million. That means we're looking at making 22 million savings in next financial year. That is for a council that has already, had to review and restructure so many times over the last, I would say, 14 years of kind of austerity. That's going to bring a real challenge. There are areas where we can, if you like, invest to save. So we've done a lot of work around special educational needs in terms of bringing in new additional resource provision, thanks to some capital funding coming out of DfE. And that's kind of gives you that sort of long-term saving in that you are looking after your children locally in borough rather than sending them out to independent settings elsewhere with the cost of transport that comes with that as well, with the high independent setting fees that come with that as well. It could be that we could do more work in that area when it comes to sort of some of the care requirements of our children and even adults in terms of, supported accommodation, that kind of thing. But we need that capital investment, I think, to do that invest to save approach. And if you can't invest to save, then it's cuts or closures.
Okay.
There's just income generation. We can look at our commercial opportunities. We're constantly reviewing all of this. And we have a transformation director who's bringing forward proposals and we're attempting to move swiftly. And just to reassure you a bit, though, we still have, we have a really good understanding of our finances. Got a good understanding of our reserves. Many of those are ring-fenced or allocated reserves, but we're in a position to shore up our key services. We're not about to go under in terms of our statutory duty, but there will be cuts. There will.
Just thinking about the mayoral elections, should we touch on that for a moment? Sadiq Khan going for a third term in office. What do you think his biggest selling point to Londoners actually is? There are significant issues in the capital around crime, around home building that we touched on, around transportation, education, many issues. What do you think Sadiq Khan's biggest selling point to voters in the capital is going to be?
He's dynamic. He gets out, he understands the communities, he gets across London, he knows what Londoners need, and he's a great advocate for London. He knows how to sell London. And if we are going to see an economic upturn in the next couple of years, he's going to be primed and ready to seize it. So that we can't underestimate coming out of the crisis after crisis after crisis we've had, how important it is to have someone who knows what he's doing. He's a really, really, really good politician. He understands the food poverty period we've been through. You know, it's quite progressive to have brought in that free school meals piece and to have repeated that commitment. The fact that he knows it's hard for Londoners to get around when money's tight, so freezing fares. The fact that he understands the importance of house building and is making that commitment. And actually, in terms of crime and policing, he's making huge commitments around improving safety in London as well, working with his deputy mayors around violence, tackling violence against women and girls, understanding the nighttime economy, understanding all those pressures. So I think to bring that experience and competence in a period where we just want to get out of crisis, we want to get to a steady footing, is an absolutely great selling point. And we're always really, really pleased to see Sadiq in Hackney.
Well, Mayor of Hackney, Caroline Woodley, thank you for coming on and giving us this kind of close-up view of some of the difficulties trying to manage local government finance books in a sort of very difficult time with cuts coming and on the eve of this London mayoral election coming in May. It's worth saying there are a list of candidates nearly being published today. The current list of nominees stands at, you're going to have Reform UK Howard Cox, the other sort of key frontrunner Susan Hall from the Conservative Party, Rob Blackie from the Liberal Democrats, Zoe Garbutt from the Green Party, and a number of other independents including Natalie Campbell, Cheyenne Batra, Taryn Guttale, and Andreas Mitchley, who will also be running.
Well, it's not been all doom and gloom today. The public sector may be facing huge challenges, but the private sector is doing pretty well, at least if you look at the results from Lloyds of London, which reported their best annual results since 2007. Now, this is the world's largest insurance and reinsurance marketplace, and one of the many firms that both major political parties want to see reinvesting money and supporting the UK.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, these are exactly the kind of CEOs and financial services that Rachel Reeves talks about, bringing investment back, growing UK productivity, bringing growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they get a lot of their money from overseas, though. But they are based here in London. And I've been speaking to the CEO of Lloyds of London, John Neal, about their very positive earnings for 2023.
It's great, isn't it? I mean, to be reporting growth and B, to be reporting strong revenue earnings is just good news. I think it's good news for UK PLC as well. You know, 80% of our flow comes from outside the UK. So I just hope it reinforces the credentials of the UK as a financial services market. So good all round. And dare I say it, good for customers too, because you want a profitable insurance industry to think about the different products and services that they need, particularly in a riskier world.
John, when we met a couple of months ago, you were very positive. You were looking to the United States for growth and you've delivered in these results. But how unusual is it? How fragile is this performance in your view?
I don't think it's fragile. I mean, I think you know the story from when we spoke last time. We've been working for 5 years consistently to improve performance, reduce costs, show leadership where we think we can show leadership. So as was said in the introduction, yes, for us, we had a lower frequency and severity cost of natural catastrophes and large complex risk losses. But we assume that that will happen and we don't take it for granted when it doesn't happen. So yes, profits have been enhanced a little bit by a lower frequency of natural catastrophes, but I'm sure we're going to end up talking a little bit about the Baltimore loss and there you have a very substantial risk loss, which we would expect in the normal course of events.
Well, indeed, let's compare that to previous marine losses. How does it compare?
Joe, the good news is when I sit sometimes and talk to you about natural catastrophes, what upsets me is how many people are not insured. The good news with this loss is the vessel's insured, the bridge is insured, the port authority's insured. So this is an insured loss. So from a financial perspective, yes, the debates will rage as to whose fault it was and who should pay what, but it is insured. So the financial power is behind the loss. But honestly, when you look at it from a marine point of view, this could be one of the largest marine losses in history.
Well, indeed, Janet Yellen, the US Treasury Secretary, says that she expects insurers to help cover the cost of rebuilding the bridge. You've got analysts at Barclays saying that smaller Lloyd's firms may be the most exposed to the claims. Have you estimated the potential claims exposure?
So two answers to that, really. So one, the way in which marine insurance happens in the world, you have these protection indemnity clubs. There are 12 of them that pool together to provide insurance. 90% of the world's shipping is with those 12 clubs. they pool together to meet their resources and then they buy insurance, and we're involved where they buy insurance. So Lloyd's has an involvement, but it is not the main involvement. There are many, many different insurers involved throughout. But I think yes, Yellen's right. This is an insured loss. So there is the financial muscle to deal with the issues that we're talking about. And you know, we visibly see the obvious damage, but it is the complexity you were talking about earlier on. It's the supply chain issues that really get quite complicated with these types of loss.
No, we understand that the marine insurers, of course, will cover a portion of the losses. But how material do you think it's going to be to Lloyd's of London as the kind of backstop after that? And just in terms of length of time, I think our audience would be very interested to understand how long something like this is going to take to unravel in terms of insurance.
So I think from our point of view, honestly, we would assume that these types of losses will occur every year. So in that respect, it's every loss is individual, but in the aggregate, yes, we assume these types of losses to occur. So we model for them, we scenario build against them. So this is within the levels of expectations that we would think could happen for this type of loss. Inevitably, and you said it in your bulletin earlier on, these things do take longer than people think. Mm-hmm. You know, constructing a bridge is a 4 or 5 year program. So I think the supply chain issues will reconcile quite quickly, and we're seeing that happen as quickly as we can. But some of the build issues just take a little bit of time. So it's not the financial preparedness to pay for the loss. Clearly, as money is needed, then money will be available. But yeah, it just does take a little bit of time to repair and reinstate.
Just staying on shipping, we've also had the attacks on shippers in the Red Sea for 3 months now. How do you see that playing out? How do you think about the shipping risks and the insurance costs?
So from our point of view, as you know, it's the Red Sea is not uninsurable. Number one, it's not uninsurable. And you've seen us also deal with the Black Sea corridor, with the transportation of grain and fertilizer. So for us, it's more about the politics and the government requirements as to what you can and what you can't do. So provided the agreements are in place at a government-based level, then insurers can step in and provide cover.
But actually, you differentiate between the Black Sea and the risks in different places. So you've pulled back from insurance around Taiwan. You've been supportive of providing insurance to Ukraine, both for shipping grain and other produce out of the Black Sea. Why those differences?
I think it's just trying to understand whether there is the appropriate intervention to give protection around the passage and transportation of people or goods. You just need the certainty that there is security in place and that transportation can be undertaken sensibly and safely. I mean, that's the one issue that we're looking for.
Okay, let's talk a bit about climate change. Mm. Swiss Re Sigma reporting this week that for 2023 insured catastrophe losses, they'll be again above $100 billion for the year. And that's the fourth year in a row. That's a huge sum. I mean, I know that Lloyd's has managed to avoid actually this year some of the major climate risks, but you can't really avoid the climate change impact.
No, so you know, the good news for us is we've got, you won't get an insurer will ever sit in front of you and deny climate change. You know, we've been looking at the data for 30 years, and a normal year costs about $125 billion for natural catastrophes. Mm. That is almost twice what it was a decade ago. So we know those numbers will grow and grow, and they'll get nearer to $200 billion or more as we recognise and realise the impacts of climate change. Do we feel comfortable providing insurance and protection? The answer is yes. Yes, we do. I think what we've got to do sometimes is just do a better job of trying to explain to the end customer why insurance is valuable and it can genuinely help when these difficult situations present, particularly the weather-related or climate-related loss.
Look, I thought one of the things from that Swiss Re report that sort of stood out is that there needs to be sustainable and affordable property insurance, that there needs to be a concerted effort by private industry, the public sector and broader society to try to mitigate these sorts of risks. Is there any country in the world that's doing that?
So I think there's lots of countries that have got problems. The US is difficult, Australia is difficult, particularly when you look at places like Queensland. But I think what Swiss Re is saying is right. It does need all info. It needs the banks, it needs the insurers, it needs the regulators, and it needs the government to sit in the same room and say, how do we reconcile and resolve the problem? Between us, I actually think we can. It's not a lack of capacity or capital. We can solve these problems.
While we're in the world of ESG, Lloyds is expected to issue a report next month on the historic involvement in transatlantic slavery of Lloyds of London. Have you ruled out compensation?
We have in terms of compensation. I think we've been without hesitation in terms of apologising for our past association with the Atlantic.
Some people will want money rather than words.
So what we've done is we've turned around, we've formed a coalition of the willing around something we've called Inclusive Futures, which basically is designed to take colleagues from black or ethnically diverse backgrounds from the classroom to the boardroom. And we've got a plan there to say, look, we want to take hundreds, if not thousands of people on that journey. So what can we do today and what can we do tomorrow to represent those people?
How's the C-suite diversity now?
It's not too bad. So at a C-suite diversity, from a gender perspective, 50-50, you might recall that for the market, we set a target for women in leadership of 35%. We've met that this year. And we've said from colleagues from black and ethnically diverse backgrounds, we want our hiring to be at 1 in 3. It's currently at 1 in 5, which is a 4% improvement on last year. So it's progress. Don't get me wrong, progress is not enough, but it is progress.
So that was the Lloyds of London CEO, John Neal. So there you have it. Major disaster over in the US, of course, will have an impact on a huge business here in the UK.
And just another reminder that, you know, we make our money, especially in the financial sector, all around the world, especially in the US, and we are tied to their fortunes as well.
Yeah, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Caroline Hepgett. We'll be back with more after the Easter break. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.